On This Week in Enterprise Tech, marijuana infiltrates the IT industry, Microsoft's $26 billion bet on LinkedIn, and John Curran from Aaron comes to talk about the state of IPv6. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 194, recorded June 17th, 2016. John Curran, Aaron, and IPv6. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Atlassian. Unleash your team's potential with collaborative software tools like HipChat and Jira, which will enable you to work and communicate better together. Visit Atlassian.com to learn more. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I can't guide you by myself. It's a mighty task, and it requires mighty geeks, starting with Mr. Lou Maresca. He is a senior lead at Microsoft, and he's got a few things to say to us this week, because it's been a fun week for Redmond. Lou, how are things up in the Pacific Northwest?
Doing great. Yeah, Twister this week. Been going around in circles. It's crazy all the stuff's going on.
Well, we're going to try to get you fired by disclosing a bunch of sensitive confidential information. But before we get to that, let's, of course, introduce my good friend, Mr. Curtis Franklin from Information Week Radio. Curtis, you are on the right coast, and are you experiencing the weather nirvana that we have here?
Well, if weather nirvana translates to mid-90s in both temperature and humidity, then nirvana is exactly what we have. We're in the early part of the rainy season, and hey, it's the tropics, so everybody's happy.
Indeed. And speaking of nirvana, we've got a nirvana-ish show for you today. We've got, yes, that's right, Mr. Aaron himself, John Curran, the CEO of the American Registry for Internet Numbers, will be coming on to tell us about the state of IPv6. But before we do that, as we always do in our shows, let's jump straight in to the blips. Now, a network breach resulting in the loss of sensitive corporate and customer data can cause immeasurable financial harm, but that's not going to keep us from trying to measure it. A report from the Ponemon Institute studied more than 2,000 data breaches and found that companies typically lose between $158 and $355 per record stolen. This, combined with the fact that the average time to identify a breach was 201 days, with 70 more days to containment, and that the cost of a breach rises dramatically after it has gone undetected for more than 100 days, means that the cost of a data breach now averages $4 million. Though it's not all bad news. The same report found that the single most effective breach mitigation strategy was to have an incident response team with expertise in data forensics, communications, legal, and regulatory mandates. Having such a team ready before a breach can save an average of $400,000 per breach. Bottom line, if you're an IT worker with security expertise, it might be time to ask for a raise.
Weather is big business. Deep Thunder says so. The Weather Company, now part of IBM, announced a new commercial offering called Deep Thunder this week. Deep Thunder combines hyperlocal short-term custom forecast developed by IBM Research with the Weather Company's existing global forecast model. Deep Thunder will use historical weather data to train machine learning models to help businesses predict the actual impact of weather. According to IBM, the goal is to improve the understanding of how a particular weather system might affect a business. The Weather Company will now integrate this IBM capability and broaden access on a global scale.
It wouldn't be a week without multiple Microsoft acquisitions. We all heard about LinkedIn on Monday, where Microsoft's acquiring it for $26 billion, but its second acquisition announcement for the week is at an undisclosed amount. Wan Labs is a small seven-person Silicon Valley startup that's built a way to integrate services into chat. The messaging interface lets you perform a variety of collaborative tasks, from sharing songs to giving a friend the ability to control your Nest thermostat. It pads the concept of conversation as a platform where intelligence meets conversations. Just by the statements at Build Conference, this could mean some interesting integrations with the multiple analytic engines at Microsoft.
Imagine being part of a broadband network that allows you to almost instantly switch from one broadband provider to another without having to reconfigure your network or replace any hardware. Then stop, because you don't have to imagine it. It exists. In Idaho, the city of Amman has deployed an open access network that allows multiple broadband providers to contract service with citizens over city-owned fiber to the premise. Not only is the municipal fiber network fast, but the fact that the city owns the fiber and the providers simply come into the city's colo means that customers can switch from one provider to another simply by visiting the city's website. Since all ISPs are providing only backbone instead of distribution, the end-user hardware and network configuration never needs to change to activate a new provider. The project was started in 2009 when the large ISPs either declined to come into the city of 4,500 buildings or demanded exorbitant installation fees and monthly service charges. The city started building their own network, and today it consists of about 30 miles of fiber connecting schools, government offices, businesses, and a pilot program of private homes. There are currently only 12 homes in the pilot program in addition to those businesses and offices, but as deployment has gone smoothly, the city is now moving to wiring the remaining buildings. As for costs, the city didn't raise taxes and managed to break even within 3 years of turning on the network. Hopefully, this little city in Idaho becomes a model for true broadband competition. Hey, FCC, can you hear me now?
Get ready for a new Apple file system. Apple is planning to introduce a new file system, cryptically called Apple File System, as the default on all devices in 2017. The company has provided developers with a preview in the developer release of macOS Sierra, or 10.12, introduced this week at WWDC. According to Apple, quote, it is optimized for flash and SSD storage and features strong encryption, copy-on-write metadata, space sharing, cloning for files and directories, snapshots, fast directory sizing, atomic safe save primitives, and improved file system fundamentals, end quote. It sounds mundane, but the Apple file system promises to improve upon Apple's legacy file system, HFS Plus, which predates the arrival of OS X in 2001. It also marks the fruit of Apple's internal development efforts after the company was unable to reach a mutually agreeable licensing deal with Sun for a file system called ZFS by 2009, the year Oracle announced its plan to acquire Sun.
AMT, or Active Management Technology, developed by Intel, is a hardware and firmware technology providing more remote management tech, allowing sysadmins with the method of remotely controlling and securing PC functions independently of the OS. Hard driver boot state. A new argument on Boing Boing, as well as other security researchers, are arguing that Intel's implementation of IME, or Intel Management Engine, and the microcontroller that runs it are fundamentally insecure, leading to devastating exploits. Based on public docs from Intel, they seem to reveal that they're relying on security by obscurity. Researchers have been able to exploit weaknesses in the ME firmware and take partial control of the ME on earlier models, and now that ME cannot be disabled, becomes even more of a threat. Researchers will continue to evaluate the threat concerns, but have a long road ahead of them since ME is not open source.
The technology industry has a long history of finding massive profits when pioneering companies are willing to risk on untested markets. IBM and the PC, Apple and the iPhone, Amazon and the cloud, marijuana and Microsoft? Yep, Microsoft is hoping to cash in on the multi-billion dollar legal marijuana industry by being the first major provider of comprehensive software tools in the relatively untested and heavily regulated legal marijuana business. At issue is the fact that all states in which marijuana is legal, 25 and counting, have complex regulatory guidelines that require, among other things, tracking of every gram of marijuana from seed to sale, complete tax laws, patient information protection, and transparency for regulatory agencies. Any high cash flow business is a challenge, but conflicting laws and confusing regulatory requirements makes it difficult to operate for even the most battle-hardened financial pros. And the government side of the equation is even more difficult. Microsoft's partner in POT, Kind Financial, has created software called Agrisoft that eases the burden of regulatory compliance. Agrisoft will run in Microsoft Azure and give government offices and regulatory agencies the tools and data to monitor cannabis compliance on a state-by-state basis while simultaneously taking away uncertainty for the same from growers and dispensary operators. The end result is that Microsoft and Kind Financial can remove uncertainty from the pot business while also improving the enforcement of state laws. Time will tell if this is indeed a new, rich opportunity for Redmond, but their Azure infrastructure gives them a fantastic head start in converting IT into high T. Well, that does it for our blips. Let's go ahead and jump into the bites. This first one is all about two big players jumping into the Internet of Things. Now, Hewlett-Packard Enterprise will team up with the industrial giant GE in a new effort to go after the market to connect industrial machinery to the Internet. Now, in a deal announced today at an HPE conference in Las Vegas, the two companies will combine their strengths to attack the fast-moving market for the Internet of Things. Now, GE is known, of course, for its wind turbines, jet engines, and train locomotives, has in the last few years strongly embraced software and the ability to analyze data as a way to squeeze more efficiency out of those, and it's a point to drive home with humor in its recent series of TV ads. Now, GE also has Predix. It's a cloud service for connecting and managing devices. HPE will be GE's preferred hardware vendor when it comes to deploying Predix. HPE's executive VP John Hinshaw said that the two companies will jointly go after business in the aerospace, oil and gas, and manufacturing industries, and have been doing so informally for a while. I want to throw this to you first, Curtis. We know that there's a lot of profit to be extracted out of the Internet of Things, but specifically, why do you think HPE and GE are teaming up?
Well, I think that GE obviously has a lot going for it in that it is a major player in the non-Internet of Things. When you look at industrial production in manufacturing systems, in energy systems, all of these have GE logos written large and frequently throughout the systems. HPE has a long history in some embedded type environments. For example, HP has long been a huge player in the telecommunications back end market. So they understand what it is to be on the back end of an ongoing industrial type process. You're seeing these kind of link ups all over the world. For example, SAP and Siemens are doing link-ups for the Internet of Industrial Things. So I think that this is the kind of link-up that we're going to see more often because pretty much everyone in the space realizes that there is just too much opportunity in the industrial Internet of Things to ignore.
Lou, I want to throw over to you. Not too long ago, the TWIT crew went down to San Francisco for a DevOps conference, and GE Digital was there, and they had actually a very cool little demo of an industrial machine that had their sensors pumping data into an analytics software suite. And they were trying to show how they could do predictive analysis of potential failures of individual pieces of the machinery, which it was a great demonstration. But it seems as if Internet of Things is kind of splitting. It's no longer just Internet of Things. You have the Internet of Things, which is sort of the consumer side. Those are the wearables and the little bits of sensor technology that we can scatter around to bring in data for consumer level analysis. And then, as Curtis said, there's the industrial Internet of Things. And this is where GE thinks that they're going to be able to squeeze quite a bit of profit. In fact, GE Digital CEO Bill Ruh said in an interview last year that he expects that just their software, Predix, could bring in $15 billion by 2020. So if they're pairing up with HPE, it does mean that they think that they can capture the industrial side. They don't really care about the consumer side. What does this say to you as a employee of a company who will be playing or actually is playing in the same space? What does this tell you about the developing market of industrial Internet of Things?
Yeah, I think it's being huge. It's huge actually in the manufacturing side because, you know, I did logic a long time ago on PLCs and Siemens PLC systems, and that's huge business for manufacturers. So now you're moving down to the IoT side of things. These smaller devices, low power, they offer a lot more advantages over the PLC systems of the last generation. and you have massive amounts of data that come from them that you have to scale and do special things with it. So I think this is a huge business for any company that can kind of get into that space. You know, like you said, Microsoft isn't getting into that space. They're debuting many things like IoT Hub and other things to be actually essentially collect data, bring it in, stream it, and then again, like you said, run massive amounts of analytics on it. And so any company that can handle that amount of data and the ability to bring insights and analytics outside of it is going to be a huge value to the industry, especially in the industrial space.
Curtis, do you see this as a forward motion that we are dividing the field? It seems as if we've been making fun of the Internet of Things since there was a thing called the Internet of Things. We've called it the Internet of insecure things, the Internet of hack things, the Internet of own devices. But now it sounds as if I can have a natural difference between the devices that can be owned and it's not really going to affect me, and then those industrial devices that need to be protected, that need to have corporate IT policy in order to make sure that that data doesn't go gallivanting out into the world. Is this a good thing? Is this something that you can look at and when you're speaking to your guests on your program say, this is where we are going to be making money for the next 10, 20, 30 years?
Oh, I think it's absolutely a good thing. And the split that you talk about is a very natural one. On the one hand, you have the internet of, I won't say inconsequential things, but let's call it the internet of personal things. And that's all of the little devices, the wearables, the various things that help keep us happier and help quantize our lives. Then you have the sort of devices that help us run, manage, and analyze industrial processes. And those are the ones that have serious money attached. And as we all know, where serious money flows, technology will follow. With the industrial Internet of Things, companies are looking at the ability to do everything from predictive maintenance to serious process analysis to understand where they can gain more efficiency in their processes. And with all of that money flowing in, the vendors are developing systems that are more controllable, that are more reliable, that are more secure. Now, the good thing for those who use the Internet of Personal Things is that a lot of the benefits from these industrial things will begin to flow downhill. So ultimately, every part of the IoT will benefit. We're just going to see a lot of focus on the industrial IoT first because, well, follow the money.
Follow the money. Now, I do want to continue this story when the guest comes in, because one of the issues with this industrial Internet of Things and the explosion of these devices is we are going to need a place to put them, and IPv6 is the perfect parking spot. Let's go on to the next story. I'm very excited to talk about this because it's not often that we get to talk about a major deal that affects the enterprise world that is directly connected to one of our hosts, but we do today. Lou, I want to give this to you because you could give us insight. Again, don't tell us anything that can get you into trouble, but there was a blockbuster acquisition this week announced at the Electronic Entertainment Exposition, of all places, between Microsoft and LinkedIn. Take it away.
Absolutely, yeah. All public information here. So basically, marked as one of the largest acquisitions for the internet in a long time. It was announced this week that Microsoft's looking to acquire LinkedIn at $26 billion, which is about $196 per share, bringing in about 50% premium on the LinkedIn price closing last Friday. So that's kind of interesting. LinkedIn went public in 2011, where its stock doubled the first day of trading, where it was the biggest internet IPO since Google in 2004. Recently, though, in 2015, the shares kind of peaked and then it kind of went on the downfall. So that's kind of something interesting about LinkedIn. Other interesting facts is it reported that LinkedIn has over 433 million members, 128 million members US alone, and it holds a presence of over 200 countries. It rakes in about $3 billion in revenue each year. About two-thirds of that revenue comes from its talent acquisition or solutions division, which actually helps corporate recruiters bring in new candidates. About, I think it's $550 million just in this quarter alone for revenue. Its marketing division generates about $140 million in revenue, while its premium subscriptions are about $138 million. And last year it reported that it has about 40,000 enterprise contracts. So that's actually pretty large for acquisition, talent acquisition. In 2015, LinkedIn actually acquired Lynda.com for $1.5 billion. As you guys know, Lynda.com is a vast network of learning and training online, and it draws about $41 million in annual revenue for just LinkedIn. So that's actually pretty good from a training aspect. They hold a massive mobile presence. About 55% of all their users are actually transitioned to using mobile, and I'm sure that's probably higher now. But kind of let's go talk into the deal now. So some of the deal parts. Obviously, some of the past deals that Microsoft has had is, remember Skype back in 2011, they had an $8.5 billion deal. Nokia, their mobile division, they did a $9.4 billion deal in 2013. And then everyone remembers Mahjong, the Minecraft developer, for $2.5 billion in 2014. But as this part of this $26 billion deal, LinkedIn will retain its brand and independence, but maintain a shared sense of alignment on the different things that the two companies can do. And Jeff Weiner, the CEO of LinkedIn, will actually remain reporting to Nadella, which is the Microsoft CEO. But there's an interesting intersection here, and this comes at a very simple level as part of the company's mission statements. I think it's kind of funny, is Microsoft's mission statement is to empower people and organizations around the world to achieve more, which is a very general statement, but it means, you know, bringing people together and finding a way to make them more productive. But LinkedIn's mission statement is to connect the world's professionals to make them more productive and successful. So the key phrases are really empowering and achieving more through productivity and success by connection. So I think that kind of brings us to a very interesting discussion. There are a bunch of skeptics out there about the deal where we know right now Microsoft has about 1.2 billion Office users. And if you combine that with the data of the 433 million users in LinkedIn, you get this very autonomous social graph that's almost amplifies its effectiveness. So I want to, you know, throw it over to you guys and think, what do you think the value in this deal is? Is it the social network part of it, or is it to kind of bring in that social graph of data?
And this is actually a really good question, because honestly, LinkedIn has been one of those companies that has been puzzling to me, because they're social, but they're not social like we think of social. They are incredibly well used by large enterprises. It is a first step of contact for most people who are working in any industry. So in that sense, LinkedIn it's got a great brand. It's definitely got a profit center behind it. And yet it's always been one of those things where when I have been looking at their business model, I'm like, I don't really know how this works in with what Microsoft is doing. Some of the articles that I've read since the announcement of this deal seem to suggest that something like CRM could benefit from some of LinkedIn's processes, which, okay, that's great. I don't know if that's $26 billion great. And then, as you mentioned, there's been some other blockbuster deals. There's the almost $10 billion for Skype, which was rocky at first, but I think that's turned out well. I think that's really helped Microsoft in their unified communications efforts. There was the deal for Nokia, which we shall not utter anymore. It's become Voldemort at Microsoft. And then there was Mojang. And Mojang was actually a fantastic deal for Microsoft. I mean, I just came back from E3, and that has been a huge boom to their gaming division. So for me, I can see where they can extract value from LinkedIn. I think the price is a little bit high. I think that price is high because Salesforce was also shopping for LinkedIn. But I can't really identify the super unique value that LinkedIn brings to Microsoft. What about you, Curtis?
Well, I think that there are some pieces of this that start to make sense. And one of them is that CRM piece. I mean, there's no question that Salesforce has been a huge presence. And one of the things that's important about Salesforce is the extent to which it is a platform. It's not just a CRM package like SAP or like Oracle. Or like Microsoft's back-end packages, it's a platform that people use to build custom applications for their business. So I think that it is entirely possible that one of the things that Microsoft sees in LinkedIn is the platform capability. You see a lot of add-ins for LinkedIn. I think that there are some good opportunities there to extend those with different Microsoft products. And I think there's also a really good mobile play here, not only because of the mobile users that are currently in LinkedIn, but again, because of that mobile platform. How do you get people to continue using the basic productivity suite and all of the products when they leave their laptop, their desktop, now their convertible computers, and go to a mobile platform? LinkedIn provides some answers for that. So I think that it is entirely likely that those are the places that Microsoft was seeing value that justified the kind of price that they paid for LinkedIn. I've seen a lot of comment, both pro and con, on this for the past few days. I tend to remain, we'll call it cautiously optimistic. I think that it doesn't do Microsoft any good to mess up here. And it behooves them to really pay attention to both the culture that exists in LinkedIn users and the way that they are using that platform. So I'm optimistic that some interesting things are going to come out of this. And I'm looking forward to seeing how Microsoft is going to deal with some of the less out in front pieces of LinkedIn. Many people have forgotten that LinkedIn owns lynda.com. So there's a ton of training now out there that falls under the Microsoft tent. Lots to keep an eye on in the coming months around this particular acquisition.
Yeah, Lou, I remember hearing once someone telling me that Twitter was for posting your fake selfies, Facebook is for linking up with fake friends, and LinkedIn is for making yourself look like a fake professional. But, you know, there is, as Curtis mentioned, there is sort of this thing that you get when you buy LinkedIn, that it is the professional's playground. It's for people to either enrich themselves with via lynda.com, to connect with one another so that you know who your network is and who you can reach out to. But perhaps we can ask a different question to figure out what it is exactly that Microsoft wants. Because you are with CRM at Microsoft. Let's not talk about that so that you can speculate. Let's talk about Salesforce. Salesforce was going after LinkedIn as well, and Salesforce is CRM. What was it that Salesforce saw in LinkedIn that they desperately wanted?
You know, I think it's partially, I mean, I wonder where Yammer's kind of in that space. Are they fake business people? I don't know. Everyone remembers that, yeah, you know, Microsoft acquired Yammer. That was their first kind of jet into social networking. And now it's, to me, this is kind of their first jet and take into like the consumer social networking. But to me, they have a lot more value than I kind of think of that, like you said, the need for people that have the need for Twitter, what is it value for businesses and so on and consumers, and what Facebook's value for businesses and consumers are. And then you think about LinkedIn and you think, okay, well, people go to LinkedIn to do particular things. Like you said, find or acquire new jobs, you know, do recruiting, do other things, learn about other people, you know, have businesses learn about your past history, that kind of thing. I think that's part of the value. I think that's where Salesforce or Microsoft might look into the value and say, okay, you know, we can link up to this data, you know, because CRM is all about customers and contacts, leads, and then opportunities and acquisitions. And so, you know, bringing in fortifying that data, supplementing that data with data around a social graph surrounding professionals and their history and their, you know, what are they doing now kind of thing, becomes very valuable. There's a lot of companies out there that provide insights around your contacts, but, you know, this is coming directly from the customer, from the user perspective generally. And it becomes more valuable in that sense because, again, when you mine it, you can mine it from different directions. You can mine it from the corporation side and you can mine it from the user side. And so that's where the value comes in. And so I think the supplementing things on that side, and that goes with really anything that LinkedIn has. You can supplement pretty much any industry if you think about it, whether it's sales or Acquiring things or, just finding new people or even ads. Because, again, remember, they have an ad feed system just like Facebook. They can provide, what are professionals looking at? I'm a computer science engineer. I'm looking at particular feed items in the feed and, what ads am I clicking on? And then, providing that insight along with the talent information. I think that there's quite a bit of value there, I think, from any CRM system.
Right. We do need to move on. Hopefully we can come back to this when some more of the details come out, because it seems to me that the sentiment, especially the popular sentiment in our chat room, is that this actually was a good deal. This was a good acquisition. This is a good get for Microsoft. If they could, say, work this into Office, if they could make that sort of professional network a standard part of the Microsoft Office, that's a good thing. The only question is, did they overpay? And they probably did, but let's all remember that Microsoft was actually sitting on a quite nice war chest. Yes, and this is that's the future of Microsoft Office. Go figure. Gentlemen, when we come back, we've got a special treat for our audience. We've got John Curran. He is the CEO of the American Registry for Internet Numbers. Aaron, if you've never heard about them, you probably should look them up. Do the Wikipedia really quickly so that you understand exactly what kind of caliber of person we're dealing with. But before we get there, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, we all know that behind every great human achievement, there's a team. There's an idea. There's that team coming together with the idea to create something great. Mapping the human genome, mastering 3D printing, building the next spacecraft for exploration. All of these things started with an idea that was made real by a team. And any good business manager knows that the best thing to do with that idea and that team is to give them the resources that they need to communicate, to succeed, and then get out of the way. And that's exactly what you can do with Atlassian. Now, we've been using Atlassian at Twit as a vital piece of our creative process. Our engineering team uses Confluence to document equipment and work processes, to share results, and keep the team on the same page on each project. Everyone can see the ideas and comment on a timeline. So not only do we know where the project is headed, we know where it's been. With Jira, we can get clear and concise task management that lets us see who was assigned what and when. It also lets us manage vendors and organize our constantly growing pile of tasks, which would otherwise be overwhelming. Now, HipChat ties together everything from event planning to DevOps to interdepartment communication with real-time IM and video on any of our devices. And of course, Bitbucket lets us share, review, and improve code in real time. Bottom line, Atlassian can turn your good team into a great team. Now, from a startup to a 10,000-seat enterprise, Atlassian makes great ideas real. And so here's what we want you to do. We want you to find out if Atlassian will be as good for you and your business as it is for Twit. Visit Atlassian.com and see how Jira, Confluence, HipChat, and Bitbucket give your team everything that they need to organize, discuss, and complete their shared work. Atlassian, helping teams everywhere team up to create what's next. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. And we thank Atlassian for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to my favorite part of every show, where we get to introduce our guest. This week, it is Mr. John Curran. He is the CEO of ARIN, the American Registry of Internet Numbers. Mr. Curran, thank you very much for coming on to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you, Robert, for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, for those folks who may be tuning into This Week in Enterprise Tech for the first time, perhaps they're just getting into the world of IT and they don't understand how the internet works, at least in the United States. Can you explain to them what ARIN does?
Sure. Well, a lot of people know what the internet is and have some idea how that works. But one of the things you don't really think about is some of the infrastructure behind the internet. In order for the internet to work, every device has to have a unique address. And that uniqueness has to happen somewhere. Now, we could have had the ISPs. The first ISP chooses any number he wants. The second ISP calls the first one and says, what are you using? I'll use some others. The third one calls the first two. By the time you get up to the 50th ISP, he has to call the other 49 to see what's in use. It doesn't scale. In order to make it a scalable process, when the internet was getting going, they established a formal registry of internet numbers, IP addresses, as everyone calls it, so that when someone new was connecting to the internet, they could connect to the internet and get IP addresses that they knew were unique without having to pick up the phone and call everyone else already on the internet. So that registry function, what we call the Internet Numbers Registry System, is actually distributed around the globe in five regional organizations. One of those organizations is the American Registry for Internet Numbers. We handle Canada, United States, and about half of the Caribbean. And we're the ones that internet service providers, large corporations, ISPs, wireless ISPs, small enterprises come to get their own unique IP address block so that when they connect to the internet, their computers have unique numbers and no one else gets in their way.
Right, right. And exactly. Aaron is the body that allows us to do all of that without having to worry about every time we type in an address, every time we type in a number. Now, let's back up a little bit because I can think two decades back I was starting to get notices of IP exhaustion. The IPv4 was running out of space. When they first envisioned the system, they thought that 32 bits was going to be plenty. You'd be able to give every computer an IP address. But of course, then there was the IT explosion and we started running out. But then we created NAT, Network Address Translation, which allowed us to sort of give longer legs to IPv4. But that didn't kill the problem. It just sort of kicked the can down the road. There was a solution for IPv4 address exhaustion way back when I first heard about it, and that was IPv6. But is the IPv6 I heard about when I was a young admin the same as the IPv6 that is being pushed today?
It actually is. The history of this is interesting. Back in the early 90s, the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force, which does the internet protocols that make the internet work, a number of us at the IETF realized that the growth of the internet at that point was so fast that IP version 4, the protocol that's used to connect the internet, wasn't going to last long enough. And so we had to do something about that. We actually did two things. We were giving out address blocks in classful state. I think people might remember this. Class A, Class B, Class C, a address block that might be 16 million addresses or 64,000. Well, the smallest one, a Class C, is 256 addresses. If someone needed 1,000 addresses, you couldn't give them four Class Cs. You had to give them a Class B. You had to give them effectively 64,000 addresses, even though they only needed 1,000. So the first thing we changed is we made the internet variable. We introduced classless interdomain routing, CIDR, a notation that network engineers know as slash notation, the ability to say a network address and how many bits are significant. That let us refine our issuance of address blocks so that we weren't giving them out as fast. But even then, we still knew the internet was going to run out of address space. And we knew it was going to happen around 2015 to 2017. So back in the early 90s, we created the IP Next Generation Project, and that became what you know as IPv6 today. There have been some things. We thought IPv6 would be popular, but ultimately it solves one problem. It solves running out of IPv4 addresses. And that problem really hasn't happened until last year. Last year in the American region, in September 2015, in Aaron's region, we ran out of IPv4 addresses. So IPv6 is now taking off dramatically.
Right. I'm thinking back to Interop. When I was still working with the Interop conference, we actually had an entire Class A, and I think we had four Class Bs, and then at least two dozen Class Cs. Those were the heydays, the halcyon days, where the Interop team members, we would borrow like Class B for a while so that we could spool up a bunch of devices. I think we actually gave most of those back. I think we kept a couple of Class Cs for ourselves. But we were good citizens, and we answered Aaron's call. Aaron said, look, if you're not using the addresses, you should really return them to the pool. That was the agreement. Interop, we did that. Has everyone been a good internet citizen in that respect?
Remarkably so. Two things to think about. First, even though we did IP version 6 two decades ago, it was became a production, an internet draft standard, and then a final standard in 1997. And people say, well, if it hasn't been deployed, obviously it's a failure. It did get deployed. It got deployed where it had to be deployed. It got deployed into the operating systems like your Linux and your Mac OS and your Windows all support it. It got deployed in the backbone routers. Routers from major vendors, Cisco, Juniper, all ended up supporting V6 a decade before anyone needed it. We had to do IPv6 and get it standardized so long ago so it would already be installed in all your equipment, ready to turn on when it actually was needed. That's why we were doing it two decades ago. But the other thing to think about is that when we got close to the end, and in the Aran region, that's been over the last 5 years, we've been slowly running out. A number of organizations that had large address blocks that didn't need them, including the folks at Interop, the folks at the Department of Defense, my alma mater, BBN, Bull, Brennick, and Newman, the original operator of the ARPANET, Stanford University, all returned address space so that we could continue to issue IPv4 to customers, and that's how we got as far as we did. But there's only so far you can make IPv4 last. IPv4 only goes, at the end of the day, it's only 32 bits, so it only goes to 4 billion devices. 4 billion devices isn't enough to let everyone on the planet have one cell phone, let alone every server, let alone your home computers, everything else. So we knew V4, no matter what we do, wasn't going to cut it. And IPv6 actually is taking off remarkably fast.
Yes. I mean, all of our devices. If you've bought a device, okay, let me say this. Unless you're using an antique device, it most likely supports dual stacking. So it's got IPv6 and IPv4 built in out of the box. But there would be people who say, yes, it has IPv6, but I would never want to turn off IPv4. From your perspective, does Aran keep track of how much of the IPv4 space is actually being used versus allocated? Because there are, I mean, if you look at the IPv4 map, there are still some sort of legacy handouts of IPv4 addressing space that you can almost guarantee is not being used even 10, 20%.
So a couple of things to think about. First, it's important to remember it's the public internet that's going IPv6. It's not everywhere. You have a printer under your desk that speaks IPv4. Let it speak IPv4. You don't need to switch. But the public internet doesn't have a choice because the number of new devices, mobile devices, tablets, all getting connected requires IPv6. If you look at what the mobile devices, a lot of people run IPv6 on their smartphone. They don't even know it because their major carrier, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, have switched to using V6 already. So the public internet doesn't get a choice. That doesn't mean enterprise needs to change its internal network. You can go dual stack on your network. But the main thing is to think about your public-facing website, because more and more devices are going to be trying to access your website over IPv6. And if you don't support it, then you're going to have a problem. Regarding those old IPv4 legacy addresses, we actually did establish a market so that organizations that got IPv4, got a huge block, don't need the whole thing, can transfer the unused addresses to someone who does. So if you're a community college and you received a huge address block, it might take you a lot of work to renumber and get out of that block because you're only using 5% of it. You can get paid for the address block so that you can do the renumbering. That's part of the market we set up. And that's also a good thing for enterprises and large ISPs who need a little more time. They can probably go to the market and get one or two more address blocks, but we know that won't last forever.
Right, right. And actually, this has been one of the topics that we've covered on TWiET with a few of our other IPv6 experts, including Cricket Liu from Infoblox, talking about how, you know, he's starting to see segmentation where people are realizing, yeah, I'll get a couple of IPv6 addresses to let me link up to the worldwide network. But internally, there's no reason why I have to change my numbering scheme. It's just, you know, that's extra work that I don't have to do. Let me ask you this. If you could go back to that infographic, Kevin, when you see this kind of data, do you see companies just sort of saying, okay, IPv6 is an inevitability and we'll get here? Or do you see companies actually saying, we are going to actively push ourselves to IPv6 deployment and IPv6 compliance?
So it's actually split. We have a number of companies that basically have realized their business is increasingly dependent on the internet. So they have embraced it wholeheartedly. And for example, some of the leaders on that graphic, Facebook has switched, uses V6 internally and externally. It fully supports it. Google, same thing, has internal V6 extensively. These are companies that have really done it. T-Mobile has its whole network is V6 based. And so if you're depending on the internet, if that's your business, then there's a lot of thinking about how to make sure you don't fall behind. If the internet isn't your business and it's just a question of connecting to customers, then the real question is, what drives that? No one's going to connect the customer to the internet with V6 and not let them get to your old IPv4 website. It doesn't matter who it is. It's Verizon, Comcast, T-Mobile, they're going to have to make sure their customer can get to your old website. But that may go through a data center, for example. Your customer that you're selling ads to and streaming video to may be located in Boston, but you see him as in New York because that's where his V6 traffic is converted to V4 and his V4 request comes from New York to your location, your colo center, your data center, your enterprise web server. Do you care that you don't know where the customer is? A lot of marketing people care a lot about that. And the fact is, you only have a connection to the mobile provider's data center if you're not running IPv6. So if you care about accurate usage metrics, if you care about knowing where your customers are actually coming from, if you care about the reliability of audio and video streaming, you'll want to make your website connected via both IPv4 and IPv6. Google has a great web page. You go to Google and then Google IPv6. And you'll go to their stats page. And Google can actually serve the same data with V4 and V6 and measure who actually requests it over IPv6. The graph that comes up shows globally 12% of the queries to Google globally are right now coming over IPv6. Could come V4, V6, and choose V6. The others are all going V4. But you can see from the curve on that graph very quickly that websites that aren't V6 reachable are going to end up having to serve it over IPv4, and that's going to be slower. And that's going to put you at a disadvantage. If you go to the by country data and then hover over the U.S. outline, you'll see in the U.S., 27% of Google's queries right now come over IPv6. That's because of smartphones that are all increasingly IPv6 based. This number has been going up dramatically. If you want a direct connection to the customer, you really need to have an IPv6 website. If you don't, it will still work, but it will be inferior to your competitor, and it will get in the way of you actually being able to get an end-to-end connection. So, it's a question of time. The more reliant on the internet you are, the more likely it is you really want to dual home your website, IPv4 and IPv6.
I was just about to ask you that because when you see those traffic stats, they do seem to correlate almost linearly with the increase of mobile traffic. And you did mention T-Mobile is all IPv6. I think Verizon is almost all IPv6. There's a couple legacy that they haven't switched over for like the little dongles that you have on laptops. But it absolutely makes sense for mobile ISPs to have all IPv6 because they sell tracking information to advertisers, and that's the only way that they're going to be able to offer reliable statistics. How much of this IPv6 adoption is going to be driven by those mobile devices that, honestly, people are never going to care if it's IPv4 or IPv6?
So it's interesting. Your mobile device, like I said, most people don't even know they're using IPv6. You go out, and most of the mobile networks, you're using it today, and it finds a way to an old IPv4 website. And so it's not that your phone has to worry about it, though if you're an application developer, Apple made it very clear that those web apps you're writing for the phone, those applications you're writing for the phone had better support IPv4 and IPv6. And in fact, their store will soon be enforcing that if it's not already doing so. So it's not an end user issue. The end user gets connected to the internet on a smartphone. He doesn't know how it is. But if you're actually trying to reach that smartphone with an application, or you're trying to have a website that has a mobile presence that might be used, it will be faster over IPv6. Additionally, broadband users are now switching. A number of people have told me, I'm running IPv6 at home. I didn't do anything. I go, oh, okay. You're probably running Comcast. Comcast has been enabling IPv6 down to the home CPE router. And suddenly you find IPv6 on your Wi-Fi network working. And so it's not just mobile. It's broadband being turned on. And that's having quite an impact. If you're doing streaming, for example, and you're relying on streaming movies, you have to expect the fact that a good number of your broadband connections are going to be connecting with IPv6 protocol.
All right. I want to bring my co-host back into the mix here. But before we do that, I do have a question from the chat room that I want to throw out there. Emily the Strange, longtime member of the Twiet Riot, she wants to ask you specifically, what's the interaction between Aaron, the IETF, and IANA? She wants to know if you have secret meetings in smoky back rooms to discuss the future of the internet.
Actually, we have very public meetings, but let's make it simple. So the IETF defines these protocols, the internet protocol, TCP, HTTP, our protocols, SMTP, your mail protocol, are all IETF protocols. And the IETF looked at the numbers, the IP addresses, and said, we're going to need to distribute those. That's not a standards job. That's a registry job. And so has worked with the five regional internet registries, which Aaron is one, to handle that administration. That's what we do. There is a group called the IANA, which maintains all of the central registries. So like port numbers. Port 80 is HTTP. We all know that. Okay, where'd that come from and who's recording it? The IETF uses the IANA to keep track of all of the tables, all of the registries for all of its internet protocols. And that includes the IP addresses. So there's a central group called the IANA. It's a function that maintains all of the IP tables, the central ones, all of the protocol numbers, all the port numbers, all the MIME types are all maintained by the IANA. It's a big list of registries. So the IANA right now is operated by a group called ICANN, same folks who handle DNS issues. ICANN, the IETF, the RIRs, W3C, the people who do web standards. We actually do all get together once or twice a year. We don't get together to have secret meetings. We get together to coordinate and make sure we're working together nicely. So there is a group of meetings that happen. We generally put out announcements afterwards and say what we talk about. It's mostly to make sure we're working well together, not to plot the future of the internet. Future of the internet is set by the people who use it.
I want to go ahead and bring my co-host back into the discussion. Curtis, let me start with you because you've been with Twiet the longest. IPv6 is probably second only to net neutrality and the topic that's important, and yet people are sick of hearing about. It's just one of those things where we're always pushing the IPv6 rock. We're trying to get people to adopt. We're trying to get people to see why it's better for them to use V6 and essentially why you have to at least dual stack all of your services and applications. Where do you think we are now versus where we were the first time Twiet talked about IPv6, which I think was, 4 years ago, like episode 5?
Well, I think we're definitely much farther along in terms of having systems that are using IPv6 and are IPv6 compatible. It's that wonderful spot where, for the vast majority of users, if they're aware of IPv6 at all, they don't care. And in many ways, we have done, as an entire industry, a pretty good job of making it so that they don't have to. The level of ignorance with which someone can successfully use the internet is amazingly high. And that's a good thing. We're long past the era when you had to be a technology expert in order to just use the internet. When it comes to large enterprises, I think the vast majority of them are frankly on the same basis. IP addressing, whether it's V4, V6, dual stacking, whatever it is that is required to enable the devices to continue to get access to the internet and for people on the internet to get access to your goods, services, and information, you have a relatively small number of people in the IT organization who are deeply invested in knowing all about this and everyone else in the organization who can be blissfully ignorant. I think that's a credit to everyone involved in the entire addressing issue that can remain true.
Indeed, indeed. Lou, again, Microsoft has been dual stacking since XP. Was it XP the first OS that had the dual stack built into it?
I'm actually not sure.
Good question. I know it was very early on, at least in 2000. I know definitely by 2000, Windows 2000, IPv6 was maybe not a default, but it was something that you could install. It was in the basic network pack. Is this even a discussion at Microsoft anymore? I mean, they just assume everything's going to be at least dual stack, yes?
You know, there's a lot of software systems, especially legacy systems, you know, like older versions of, you know, Windows and so on, you know, Xbox even. And, you know, some of them support dual stack and some of them support, you know, one or the other. So I think, you know, it is usually, I mean, new software, no, it's not usually a discussion. Usually it's just, hey, everything's kind of dual stack supported. But, you know, and Azure itself can handle that translation and so on. So I think, you know, there are discussions when you're handling some of the legacy software pieces.
Right. John, let me get you in here. One of the issues that we used to have at Interop when we were playing around with this was there are many implementations of DHCP with IPv6. There is no standard for DHCP with IPv6. How close are we to getting to something that we can all agree on?
So this is an interesting question. As it turns out, much of IPv6 looks like IPv4. But some of the places where they innovated when going to IPv6 was there were different approaches to how address distribution should be handled. We ended up with protocols for automatic distribution, Slack and other protocols. And in fact, there was a thought that maybe we don't need DHCP. There's a number of people who feel we need a DHCP6. There are specifications for it. And the internet doesn't deal well with top-down direction. It's really not how we do things. It's also why, even though we use a small number of protocols to keep the internet running, there's actually hundreds of internet protocols and thousands of specifications. So right now there is a DHCP v6 you can use as a spec for it. There is auto configuration options that let you do router announcements that will let you do address distribution that way. You get to choose which it is. There's no standard way of doing it because some people like the control that one provides over the other. With like a lot of other things in IT, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, when we see what the industry's actually using, I'm sure some of these options will fall by the wayside. But right now, there's a variety of options. And one of the things when you go to do IPv6 is you do have to learn there are differences. Address distribution is one of the differences you have to pay attention to.
Right, right. I remember at one point there was a IPv6 engineer who no longer works in IPv6, but he was saying, well, I mean, since there are so many IPv6 addresses, every device could just have an IPv6 address automatically and report it. Not a great system. We tried that at one camp, and that did not turn out well. I do need to throw in that Chibert is in our chat room right now, and he mentions that he thinks dual stack was built in to Windows 98, which is way before I thought it was. If that's true, kudos to Microsoft for that. John, where are we? This is something that you do with on a daily basis. In terms of adoption, the United States seems to be doing pretty well. We saw that infographic that shows that IPv6 traffic is rising, especially queries to Google. Yes, a lot of that is mobile devices, but still that counts. Where are we in the state of IPv6? Are you happy with how fast we're moving? Are you happy with how companies are dealing with IPv6, or is there still more education that programs like This Week in Enterprise Tech need to push out so people are aware of IPv6 issues?
You ready? It's an interesting question. And I want to first point out, IPv6 deployment on the internet is potentially the world's largest technical change project affecting every organization connected to the internet on a global basis, happening over decades, with no central authority and no one in charge. When you think about the project that way, you have to set realistic goals. This literally is an evolution. And so in that respect, I'm actually quite pleased where IPv6 is. We actually, when we ran out in the ARIN region of IPv4 addresses, the ARIN region free pool, in September of last year, 2015, we were in a situation where any organization that wanted to connect up customers with IPv6 had the technology it needed. Anyone could get the router support, they could get the firewall support, there were security equipment that supported it, all of that was available. There was no question about whether or not customer devices supported it or not. The vast majority of everything we needed to have in place for that runout last year was in place. And in fact, not only was it in place, but you saw companies like Google and Facebook and Comcast and Verizon all taking advantage of it. We are now at the point where it's very clear the growth of the internet at the core is going to be V6. If you look at the largest companies that are internet-based, their whole strategy is based that way. The companies that are connecting up new customers. Is it going to take a while for it to get to the edge? Yes, it is. It's going to take a long time. We still know there are probably organizations out there running SNA and DECnet and IPX as well. It's going to take a while before every protocol disappears. We may see IPv4 for two decades still, but IPv6 has achieved what it needed to do. It is now the direction of growth, and that means we're over the hump. The most important thing for enterprise to remember is, again, it's public-facing connection that it's building. People worry about building websites and making sure that their customers and business partners can get to them. Don't do 95% of the project and get a 50% grade on it. Don't build an entire application or an entire website to meet some business need and then only connect it up with IPv4. That only gets you halfway there. You do a little bit more work and a little bit more QA, and you'll be on IPv4 and IPv6, and you won't have to worry about it. If you're going to do a project to connect to the internet or to put an application on the internet, do the whole project. Get 100%. Don't do 95% of the project. Drop the ball on the V6 connectivity and only get a 50% grade.
Well, folks, I'm afraid you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 IPv6 to 4 tunnels. I want to thank our guest today, John Curran, again, the CEO of the American Registry of Internet Numbers. It is an absolute pleasure to have you on. Could you please tell the folks at home where they can find you, where they can find ARIN, where they can find your work, and maybe tell them about, I believe you have a panel coming up in the end of July if they want to hear more about IPv6.
So we do have information online. If you go to www.arin.net, you'll find all the information about IPv6 and IPv4, basic information. You can also go to Team ARIN, T-E-A-M, ARIN, ARIN.net. That actually has the website of our social outreach, speaking events, and calendar. And we also have an IPv6 specialized website, which is up here, the Get IPv6 Info. A lot of information available online, and I'm also reachable. You can find me on Twitter, and not a problem there. Happy to, if anyone has questions about what to do to get to IPv6, feel free to pick up the phone or drop an email to us at ARIN. We're used to it. We'll help you get over the curve.
I love that. I love that. And we are actually trying to get a panel together here for This Week in Enterprise Tech of a few IPv6 engineers. I'd love to have you back. The one thing we've been waiting for is we need to find a couple of engineers who are not happy with the state of the deployment. Otherwise, it will just be a very boring panel. Would you be willing to come back on the show?
Absolutely. Anytime, let me know and I'm there.
Again, an absolute pleasure. John Curran, CEO of ARIN. And we thank you for being on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you.
I also need to thank my co-hosts. I couldn't do the show without them. They make it not just more entertaining and more educational, but they make it more fun for me. Let's start with Curtis Franklin. What's going on at Information Week Radio? Where can the Twiat Riot find you?
Well, as always, I'm writing a lot at Information Week, doing Information Week Radio. I'm also exploring different kinds of social media. I just started doing Snapchat recently. It's really interesting. I have taken a position. I'm on the board of directors for the SPJ's digital community, and I'm on that board with a bunch of folks who are rather younger than I am. So it's a good experience for me getting out there and finding new ways to tell stories. So that's where you can find me, kind of everywhere. Keep looking me up and I'll keep trying to tell stories.
Fantastic. And remember, Curtis Franklin isn't just a geek. He's my geek. Whatever that means. Let's also thank Lou Maresca. Lou, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. It's always a pleasure to have you on This Week in Enterprise Tech. And you are in the regular rotation for taking over anytime I leave. So, yes, this definitely is your show now. Could you tell the folks at home where they can find you, where they can find your work, and maybe where they can find the official Microsoft statement on the CRM and LinkedIn?
Sure. You can always find me on Twitter at LouMM. And also you can find me on LinkedIn. At LinkedIn.com/IN/LouisMaresca. And you can always find my work with CRM at MicrosoftCRM.com. And there's some great information. If you go to news.microsoft.com, you can see all the information around the LinkedIn announcement and the integration of potential Dynamics and LinkedIn itself.
Indeed. Lou, Curtis, thank you again. And folks, thanks to you, the person who drops in each and every single week. We wouldn't have a show without you, without your support. And we want to make it easier for you to get your Twiat fix. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiat. There you will find not just all of our past episodes, not only will you find our notes and the links of the stories that we've covered during the show, but you'll also see a little drop-down menu for you to subscribe to the show in the format of your choice. Do you want an audio version on your iPhone so you can listen on the way to work? You could do that. Do you want a video version on, say, your Android tablet so you could watch us on your break? You could do that. Do you want the high-definition video on your laptop or your desktop so you can watch us in all our HD glory when you get home? You can do that. Again, that's twit.tv/Twiat. Don't forget that you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. It's actually the best place for you to suggest guests and topics for future shows. Again, twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's at PadreSJ. And not only will you be able to contribute to the show, but you'll also be able to find out what I do when I'm not working at Twit TV. Also, don't forget that we do this show live every Friday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time. Live.twit.tv is the address for you to see the pre-show, the post-show, and everything in between. And as long as you're watching live, why not jump into our chat room at irc.twit.tv? I pull questions straight out of the chat room. It's a great way for you to be involved in this interactive experiment that we call Twit TV. Finally, thanks to everyone here at the Brick House who makes this show possible, to Lisa and Leo for letting us do this show, to Chibert, my brand new producer who's doing a fantastic job with getting us great guests like John Curran, and to my TD, my technical director, Kevin, do you have a camera on yourself, or can you pull up? There you go. Of course, we now end every show with this wonderful segment that we call Stump Kevin. And Kevin, the question this week is, how many addresses are available in IPv4?
Man, I closed out of the window. Not enough.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. The answer is blue.
What?
Maybe next week. Okay. Thank you very much, Kevin, and thank you for directing our show. Folks, until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, saying, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.